We are live on the Booze Dancing Entertainment Network. What we watch, when we drink, and we've got a special one tonight, don't we, guys?
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. Now, the last two were more movie, less booze, and both guests last time, last name with a Z.
That's right. No Z's.
No Z's, more booze, less movie.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
I'm in.
So okay. We are very lucky to have a couple interesting guests tonight. One that we met a long time ago, one that we met a few months ago, and they actually work for the same company, which is perfect.
Excellent. Perfect.
Excellent. All right. So let's start the show, roll the intro, and then we'll come back and start chatting.
Welcome to What We Watch When We Drink, a Booze Dancing Entertainment Network podcast featuring lively discussions about movies, TV shows, and anything else that we're watching while we drink our favorite boozy beverages. If you enjoy this show, please subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, Google, Audible, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. You can also find us on boozedancing.com, and if you have any questions, comments, show, or drink suggestions, email us at boozedancing@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.
And we are back. Welcome to all that are out there watching on Boo. Where are we? On YouTube and Facebook and where else? Twitter. Where else can you see this thing?
LinkedIn.
LinkedIn. Right, right. Yeah, where you post your resume and you can watch a video of us.
Exactly.
And Disney. I saw Disney.
And, well.
Soon. I wish. We're working on that, Joe.
So we are very lucky tonight to have two fellows from the Barrel Craft Spirits Company. We are welcoming in founder Joe Beatrice and Trip Stimson, the chief whiskey scientist from Barrel. Guys, welcome.
Thank you. Happy to
be here. Welcome.
Now, we met Trip about, what, Ange? We met him about 2 months ago?
Yes.
In New York City at the Kiddish Fest Whiskey Festival. And that's how we got together. And then we met Joe about 10 years ago. We were discussing earlier at inside of Park Avenue Liquors. The three of us were there, and we happened to see Joe at the very beginnings of this company, right, Joe? And he was selling
his
wares.
What the hell is that?
Yes, pretty much. Yes.
It was so. We were just talking about how it was the old Park.
The old location.
Park Avenue Liquors, yeah.
And it was like the old, small, tiny location, crowded. It was, you had to stand like this. And yeah. It was the good old days.
Yes. You were pouring samples and trying to drum up some new business for your new company at the time, right?
Yeah.
So before we get too far along into our evening, we are going to be tasting some whiskeys that that the guys at Barrel had sent along to us, some of their expressions. And we're going to be talking about a movie that they picked out for us, National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation from 1989. So before we get to the movie, and before we even start tasting some whiskey, well, we could taste some whiskey first. Should we do that first?
Yeah, let's do that.
So
a little history, a little whiskey, it's all good.
Yeah, well, and we're going to let you guys talk a little bit about Barrel and how you guys started, what you guys do, philosophy, and where you are right now. So you said to pour that bourbon first. Batch 35, 6-year-old, 117.5.
Was that it?
That's it.
Is that all?
That's it. It looks like this. Can you guys see that one? It's got the black label on it. That's one. All right. Right there, right there's there. The bottle, which I have to say, those bottles are really sexy.
They did. They're like nice little flasks.
Oh, my God.
They were awesome. Nicely packaged, by the way. Excellent job on the seals.
Well,
no spillage.
Oh, my God.
Beautiful.
Just like the owner.
Village. So before we go too far, we got to say a little cheers to everybody.
Well, let's pour.
Thanks for dropping in. Thanks for coming on the show. And thanks for watching at home, you guys. Cheers.
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 Excellent. Excellent.
All right. So before we get into the history of Barrel, what are we drinking here?
So what we have for you guys tonight is the first sample is our batch 35. It says 6 on the bottle. Obviously, we have to put the youngest age on the bottle. But this is a blend of whiskeys aged from 6, 7, 8, and 13-year-old from three different states, Indiana, Tennessee, and Kentucky. And something that we're doing a little different now, a lot of times when we talk about mash bills, we can't just give a a straight on answer to the mash bill, because we use so many different mash bills from so many different states. And so the customer is very interested in the amount of grain that ends up in these blends and how that affects the flavor. So what we've done is started doing a derived mash bill where based on the volume of each of the mash bills, the grains included are calculated by percentage. Oh. So in batch 35, what we're going to have is a 78% corn, an 18% rye, and a 4% malted barley.
So it's just an average of all the numbers of all the different barrels you put together.
Correct.
Well, it's weighted based on the volume. This is something that people were asking for, and you know, and we've always been as transparent as we can be, and so we thought this would be sort of the next best thing to start revealing, which is. Because yeah, we always get that question, what's the mash bill? It's like, there isn't one, but it's this. So now we're spending more time on, we're also giving more emphasis on the ages and the states that are in the particular blend. Because that, at the heart of it, that's, we are blenders. That's what we started with. That's what we've been doing for the last 10 years. And that's our superpower.
So when you said the word transparent, and on the newest Marvel,
you know, episode, when someone asks for the mash bill, just say delicious. That's all. Don't worry about it. Like don't worry about it.
Yeah. Forget about it.
Forget about it. Don't worry about it.
So when you said transparent, and I was doing some little research on you guys, and we know of you for a while now, my first thought was you're an American version, not similar to Compass Box. You are trying to come up with expressions by putting lots of things together.
Yeah, I mean, historically, you know, it's a merchant whiskey business in Scotland. I mean, we talk about that a bit. We borrowed from that model, and it was not really done with American whiskeys when we started doing it. But yeah, I mean, we definitely were influenced and inspired by that.
So, how did you come up with the idea?
So the whole thing started. So I have my background. Is in the digital realm and in also traditional advertising, and then and so I started a company that was in the middle of the Silicon Valley boom in the 90s and 2000s, and along the way I had a spirits vertical, and so we did a lot of work with different brands, and I came to Kentucky, you know, a long time ago, and fell in love with the state. At one point, it'll be 12 years ago in November, my wife and I were at this chance, went to a distillery to visit it and just look at it. And I'm standing there going, in the same way that I got into the internet early, this is what we need to do next. We need a distillery. And so at home, and I locked myself away, and it took about literally 7 days to come to the conclusion that we do not want to build a distillery. The investment is crazy. It was just me in my bedroom when I started. And, you know, I knew I didn't have the expertise until I met Tripp then. And I knew that the way to go was the value was in the brand and creating a product that was superior. And so then it was literally one year from that moment to when we bottled the first product. The rest is history. And then I met Tripp.
I always love this part of the history of our story, because when I first met Joe, I had spent most of my life in sort of the corporate distilling world and worked in lots of larger distilleries on distillery sciences, yeast fermentation, distillation. And in around 2012, saw the craft boom was really starting to take place and wanted to be a part of that, leverage my expertise and help people who wanted to get into the industry get a realistic picture of what it really meant to design, build, and operate a distillery. Because I think there's this idea this is some big rosy vacation sort of, if you build it, they will come type of thing. And it is nothing could be further from the truth. And so in my consulting journey, would talk a lot of people out of building the distillery and toward building the brand, because the brand is where the value was. So it was really great. The first synergy that Joe and I had was when we first met and started talking about building a distillery, he figured it out. He says, yeah, I wanted to do that for about a week and decided that was not what I needed to do. And I'm thinking, this guy's done his homework. So he really knows what's going on. And so we really started talking about building a brand, what that looks like, how to set us apart, and you know, how to focus on putting the flavor in the bottle where the consumer is really going to have access.
So instead of making your own product, you're sourcing it from other people, right? How much harder or easier is it now to get casks to make the things that you want to make?
There is and always has been so much whiskey out there. Now more than ever, because all the production facilities that came online 5 years ago, especially Kentucky bourbon, there was massive amounts of Kentucky bourbon. But you know, we've been lucky. We've had good relationships with a lot of producers, you know, and a lot of it comes from that there's a respect for the product and, you know, and how we use their products. And so everything to us is an ingredient into making a blend. And, you know, when I met Tripp, that was, we hit it off and similar philosophies. And also our palates were so compatible because we like the same things. We dislike the same things, but we have different fault sets that we detect, which is really sort of, when you think about it. So what we're doing is we know what we shouldn't be in there. And there are some things that my palate is really sensitive to and some things that Tripp's palate is sensitive to.
So I'm guessing you're getting a bazillion samples from all these, wherever you're sourcing, you're trying these samples. And Joe, you know, when you taste a sample, that's Tripp's not going to like it. And Tripp, when you taste a sample, you know, Joe's not going
to
like it.
I was just getting ready to go there because that's exactly the way this happens.
Yeah.
Is that we'll be sitting there tasting all these samples and Joe will go, well, I know which one you like. I was like, well, I know which one you don't like. And so that's how those conversations have. And then more often than not, we're right.
When you are getting ready to release a batch, do you kind of have an idea of where you want to go? Or do you base where you're going to go based upon what you're getting from the distilleries? Do you know what I mean? Like, you already have a concept or?
I think we do sort of have a concept. And the way I explain this is it's kind of a Cliff's Notes version of this because we deal with these barrels all the time. So these different mash bills have sort of a bucket of characteristics that we're very familiar with. So we can speak about these mash bills in lots of barrels and sort of that's code for what we know to be the flavor profiles of these mash bills.
Okay.
So we'll speak in terms of like bulk mash bills, which is really concentrated amounts of flavor to build what we would call a base blend. And then once we have the base blend put together, it's about filling in gaps in the flavor profile.
Okay. So you kind of have an idea of what you want to do.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's just a question of getting the right component to make it where you want it to go.
Yeah. We also know a lot about how they'll blend together.
Right.
You know, and it's funny because we're moving to a new space, which we can talk about later. And we're going through all of our old sample bottles and we have a palette of sample bottles that were, you know, we have a library, but even with a library, we have that many more samples. And so, you know, the other part of it is what we do is real art and science. To put together a matrix of about 300 different combinations when we did our toasted barrel experiment from different kinds of wood, different age wood, different season length of time on the wood, different age product that went in there, different mash bills. So we know what every whiskey that we have access to, how it reacts in any kind of toasted barrel.
When you get a sample, does this kind of thing happen? You taste a sample and you go, oh, this would work great with that sample 6B up on that shelf over there, that barrel. I think these two things will go together.
It can be something like that. More often than not, it becomes the defining piece of a matrix component that we have set aside where we know that there's a component that we want to use as a part of a batch, but we know that it's missing something. And so when we taste through some of these samples, it's kind of like, ah, that's the missing piece. And we know where that piece fits in the puzzle.
So you said you're moving to a new location. You got a rick house. So you must have a lot of barrels. I don't want to ask you how many, but you must have a lot of barrels sitting there waiting to be blended.
Tripp can speak to the rick house because this is his, he loves that place. We've spent so much time in rick houses, and it's so funny. Trip, I came across some pictures of when we're out one time. We spent a day. We were filthy. We spent a day crawling around taking samples out of our barrels, and you just are immersed in this unbelievable environment. But what we've done is we're slowly moving in our barrels because we have them all over the country. And we're filling up this rick house, but you know, we're trying to do it in a thoughtful way. But you can speak to the rick house because this is really cool.
Yeah, these rick houses are really a cool place to be. And if you've never been in one and you're listening to this, I encourage you to go see one, preferably a historic one, because they're just incredibly fascinating the way they build these things. And the one that we purchased was actually built in 1940 by the Dant family. It was one of the original Yellowstone warehouses in Shively, Kentucky. It was one of six that were down on that 10-acre plot, and we own the only one that's left. It's five floors. It has 42 ricks per floor, and there's three rails per rick, so we can store about 18,000 barrels in there. And there's a couple of old foundations that are actually still on the property too. So if we ever wanted to build a couple more of them, we've already got the foundations in place to re-erect the structure. So it's a really, really neat piece of history.
I mean, the other thing that fascinates me about this place is the wood, it's a different wood because it was so dense. When you look at this wood and you look at wood that's being used now to build, I mean, structurally, it's very different. So there's something really amazing about this, about the way this is constructed. Also, it was constructed for people who are about this wide to get between the ricks. People were smaller then. I think.
Yes, and sure.
And then the other thing about this place, which I am really fascinated by, is there's a natural ventilation. So air circulation is critical in barrel maturation. And which is why ricks are very different from palletized storage. And so underneath the first floor are these big cavern tunnels that connect to the outside that they use to bring air from the outside and circulate the air through. It's sort of like the way that Washington buildings were built to create a kind of air conditioning when they were first built, which was they used the natural convection of air to move airflow to move through. So there's a lot of nuance to that place.
All right, so gents, what did you guys think of this bourbon?
That is really, really nice.
It was so freaking easy
to drink. I was surprised it wasn't that hot.
No.
Yeah.
When you see the number on the bottle, you think this might have a lot of heat to it, but it was easy drinking, you know. I look at some of the high ABVs and you think it's almost like a dare. And it seems as if that's just the right temperature it had to come out at. You had to put it at it's the right number. At 80 proof, it would have been water. It's just really good.
I find it kind of light, but it's like light and fruity. It's not heavily oaked. It's not like really astringent. It's got like a nice light fruity quality to it. It's hot in the beginning, but then once you adjust to it, it's not like an oppressive heat. It's just saying I'm 117 proof. So,
I mean, one of the things that we do design into, so we spend a lot of, we it can take 100 iterations, even more sometimes to perfect where we want to be. And we do everything blind. So we taste everything blind and we back test everything against our products and against competitive products all the time. And so we know exactly where we want to be. And so part of the experience for us is that we want it to be complete. There should be the nose is important, the color is important, the first sip when it hits your palate, how it affects the side, back, everything. And so our whiskeys, you'll see that they affect your palate differently. If we were drinking Vantage tonight, that's back palate forward. So that really is expressed there and at the very beginning. This is different. This is a whole different experience, and you got it. So we wanted to have a long finish,
and it has that for sure. A friend of ours from Canada, you guys may know her with the Whiskey Lassie, Joanne McGinnis, is online with us tonight, and she has a question. She says, "Do they use mass spectrometry to fingerprint their barrels?" That's a good
question. It is a good question. And
she's a chemical engineer, so she'd ask that kind of question.
And in a perfect world, I think it would be fun to do that. I've had quite a bit of experience with some mass spec and HPLC and GC to do similar things, but we don't have that luxury currently to take advantage of that technology. And one thing that I would also argue, not necessarily against it, but for not using it for sort of this type of blending, is because when we're putting together these blends, we're really looking at this liquid in the same way that the consumer is going to be experiencing the liquid. And so by doing it all by taste, we're stepping through the process that the consumer is going to go through when they taste the final product. If we were to use some sort of piece of equipment, spectrometry or HPLC, mass specs, you know, so on, to do this type of analysis, it would benefit us if we were doing some sort of experimentation where we're looking at different pieces of the puzzle, like barrel contribution to a certain type of liquid, or maybe certain types of congener formation in a certain area of our rick house, those types of things that would allow us to control and gather data and then leverage that data into something. But since we're not focused quite in that area, it's more about how the consumer is going to experience the product. We try to do it all by taste.
Just so you know, I have access to one at work, and I know the guy that runs it.
Really?
So we can negotiate a rate, a little road trip, have a little dinner. It could be fun. So anyway.
Could be interesting.
And the former person that ran the whole thing, big bourbon fan. So I can get her on board too. So anyway, that's all. That's all I had to say.
Well, we've talked a little bit about the little bourbon, little barrel here. And now we're going to talk a little bit about a movie. Now, you guys, we went through some emails back and forth about a movie to pick to talk about tonight. And we were all over the place. John Wick and Fast and Furious, I think, was in there. And we ended up totally out in left field. National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation.
Well, it was either this or Spice Girls.
I don't remember that on the email, but okay. So how, why, you guys told us on the email, but how did you guys come up with this movie? Why is maybe the bigger question.
We went from John Wick to Fast and Furious, went through a bunch of action flicks, and it's been so miserably hot in Kentucky for the last few weeks. It's like everybody needs a little Christmas in July with the email or August right now.
This is good.
So I thought it would be a good one, maybe bring a little cooler temperatures with it. And, you know, there are so many great quotes from this movie. You can't help but love it.
You know, it's funny. It's on all the time.
Yeah, it really is.
And I don't think I even think of it as a Christmas movie because it's not on in December. It's on in the other 11 months of the year. Endlessly.
It's almost the perfect movie. There's, you know, it really is practically a remake of It's a Wonderful Life. But it also gets really dark in there. And, you know, it's the characters are just bigger than life. And we love it. We you know, it's.
So this came out in 1989. It's the third vacation movie from National Lampoon. And we'll give you a little bit of background on this. So it's based on a short story that John Hughes wrote for National Lampoon. He was a senior editor at National Lampoon back in the 70s and 70s and 80s. And he started with an article called Vacation. That was in 1979. He wrote that. That became Vacation ultimately when the movie was made. But it was told from the point of view of Rusty, not from Clark. He writes another one called Christmas 59, supposed to be 1959, and it's also told from the point of view of Rusty. And it's both of these stories are very dark. Much darker than these comedies that we see today. But you can see the underpinnings of what these movies will be from the characters. But Clark is not exactly the same Clark. It's not Chevy Chase in this original writings. And John Hughes is an executive. He's a producer on both of these movies too, I believe, right? On both of them. And all three of the first three, I think. And you have any say any details on the movie itself?
Release date December 1st, 1989. Budget $28 million. Gross box office USA and Canada 74.5. So I guess by definition, that's like a moneymaker. That's pretty good.
IMDb
score 7.5 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes 70%. Metascore 49. So filming locations, they said Chicago, but when I read some of the stuff, they didn't.
I thought it was Colorado.
Well, the one scene was in Breckenridge, I was reading. Oh, when they went and got the Christmas tree. They actually, I think, had to bring in snow for it because they had no snowfall. But the house and the neighborhood and all that, that was all done, I think, wherever the studios are. Glendale, maybe, or.
It was in Burbank.
Yeah. One of those. They were all done. It was all done on set. Yeah. But the Chicago shots are all real, down in the loop and down and all that stuff. Yeah, directed by Jeremiah Chechik.
He did have a big career.
And written by John Hughes, as you said. Apparently, Chris Columbus was the original director on this, but he couldn't stand working with Chevy Chase, so he quit.
That probably never happens, huh?
No. I guess he really is a bastard. I don't know. He's got a bad rep.
Yeah, now they just get rid of Chevy. They don't get rid of the director.
Right.
Matty Simmons was an executive producer. He's on the credits, but he's not. It's hard to find him. Matty Simmons was the CEO of National Lampoon right before they started having all their financial problems in the 70s, 80s. Interesting with Matty Simmons, he was the CEO, head of marketing for Diners Club, the very first credit card. And these guys had this idea, and they were on Long Island for this Diners Club charge card. And they had no idea what this was. They had this concept, but they didn't really know what to do with it. And then he came in and said, okay, we have to flesh this idea out. And they were the first. And they started marketing a credit card before he went to National Lampoon. And then he became a big movie producer. And the music, this is stunning to me, was Angelo Badalamenti.
I know, I saw that.
Famous for...
David
Lots
Lynch
of things,
movies.
Like Twin Peaks. Yeah. David Lynch movies. And there's no soundtrack to this movie. You can't buy a soundtrack to this movie. It doesn't exist.
Interesting.
Isn't that weird? All right. So this movie is crazy. It's a crazy Christmas movie, a feel-good Christmas movie about Griswold trying to make the perfect Christmas for his family. So he has all the extended family come to their house. Let's have the big Christmas tree. Let's have all the lights. Let's have all the beautiful things about Christmas. And of course, everything goes wrong. And he tries his best and nothing goes right. And I think that's the short story of it all.
So basically Christmas.
Gentlemen, basically Christmas for everybody, right? Exactly. Joe Tripp, thoughts on the movie?
I'm sitting here thinking through all the quotes that that we can rattle off and where to start.
For me, there's all these little character sketches, you know, like Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who she's just brilliant. And they play the next door neighbors, and do we even call anybody yuppies anymore? I mean, I think
that was the appropriate label for
that time and place.
Yes. No, yeah.
And they're just so awful.
They hate their next door neighbors, and then they're harassed by their next door neighbors indirectly, and they are just so put off by them. Nothing, they're just part of the nothing goes right.
Well, here's totally one of the quotes.
Offended by everything.
Here's one of the quotes. Ellen, I don't remember who Ellen was. I don't know what to say except it's Christmas and we're all in misery. There you go.
Isn't that
it's Christmas, right?
The wife is Ellen.
I always liked it at the very beginning.
Oh, it's the wife? Okay. Honestly, to be honest, I've seen bits and pieces of it over the years, but I've never actually sat through the entire film from start to finish.
That quote is she's talking to her daughter who is
Julia Louis.
That was something. But also, I mean, you can't ignore Cousin Eddie.
Mr. Quaid is an interesting person.
Better character in any movie than that guy.
He was born for this part, and now he's living in a trailer for this part, somewhere. You know what? Funny part of this the vacation movies is that the kids are never the same actors in any movie. Right. And there's a reason for that, because they want Chevy to, because Chevy doesn't know their names all the time, right? He's kind of like unclear who these kids are. Well, he's really unclear because they're this different person playing them every time. That was a kind of just to magnify that issue for the family. Yes. Which I still liked Rusty in the first movie, which was Anthony Michael Hall.
I kind of like Johnny Galecki, though. I thought he was pretty good.
He was good.
What's great is there are four of them that play Rusty, and three of them have long careers. And the fourth one is Ryan Reynolds' brother-in-law. So I'm not sure.
It was Ryan Reynolds' brother-in-law. Sure, that's funny.
You know, that's a good
career. Jason Lively plays the Rusty character in the European Vacation one. And
oh, that's funny.
Blake Lively's his sister. So you're like, okay, I don't know who made out better. You get to hang out with Deadpool, or you know, you're still on TV. I'm not sure which.
With all that gin money.
He's got gin and Mint Mobile money.
You're at the Wrexham. Maybe something's going on. I don't know.
Wrexham money. Yeah. Unsung hero is Beverly D'Angelo.
She's great in everything she's in.
She's great. And she's so good as this wife she wants what Clark wants, but she knows it's not going to work out. So she tries to stop him at every turn, and it doesn't matter. It still falls apart.
And she's so deadpan as everything's falling apart around her.
She's so deadpan.
It's just like, what's the next thing that Clark did that was just stupid? Okay, whatever.
Or think about Brian Doyle Murray.
The great Brian Doyle Murray. The great Brian Doyle Murray.
Did I say it right? Brian
Doyle Murray, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, just as like out of central casting for the worst CEO on the planet. Every single thing that guy does is, you know.
So Joe, you don't run your company like that? Is that what you're saying?
the one quote. Remember when I was toying with that idea of suspending the Christmas bonuses? Like, who does that? I was toying with the idea.
Brian reprising his role as the head of the caddies from Caddyshack. Yeah. But pretty much the same guy.
He's good in that character.
But what I can't get over in that is William Hickey.
Oh, I love William Hickey.
And how old do you think he is in that movie?
I don't know. 82.
He's old. He's in his early 60s.
Of course he is.
He's younger than all the other parents.
That's so
and he's
funny.
Supposed to be playing like the great uncle, because he just looks like, you know, he's City Miles.
How old did you say he is?
He's in his 60s in the movie.
Really? Was it Preetzi's Honor around the same time?
Yeah.
Because he played before. John Corrado Preetzi.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's funny.
He's born
in 1927. The next closest person to him is Doris Robertson in 25. And the two fathers are both in the teens, 1914, 1915. Well, you think he's got to be like 1900. The guy's, you know, he's got to be 80. He's 62 years old.
And his voice is so ridiculous, but he's just so memorable.
John Randolph, Diane Ladd, E.G. Marshall, Doris Roberts. That's crazy. Yeah. That's crazy casting. They said yes to this.
And I love how the in-laws to Clark are like typical in-laws. Like, I noticed the twinkle lights aren't on. Those lights are twinkling. And his father is just like the... I've already done this horrible thing. Like, okay. Life is beating you down. Welcome to my world. You know, kind of John Randolph's character is great.
Well, before we go much farther, let's try this rye. I want
to
try the rye.
I wanted to ask one question about the batches. Do you try to make the batches similar to one another, or are they totally different expressions?
They're intentionally different.
Intentionally different. Okay. Just didn't know if with the bourbon you're trying to hit like a certain kind of bourbon, or if you're just coming out each time like, this is this year's bourbon, enjoy. Next batch will be something new.
Did you want to go bourbon rye back to bourbon, or how did you want to do this?
We should do the rye next.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Because the Amaro is going to be too much.
Now the first bourbon was Kentucky, Tennessee, Indiana.
Correct.
Is this the same blends?
You mean is the rye the same state?
For the rye, same the distillers.
So no, there's going to be some different distillers here in the rye. This is going to be a blend of Indiana ryes that are 5, 6, and 10 years old, a Tennessee rye that's 5 years old, a Kentucky rye that is 6 years old, and a Canadian rye that is 14 years old.
Ooh, Joanne, there's a 14-year-old
rolling in that Canadian swill.
Look at that, Joanne. just for
and
you.
Then we have our derived mash bill of 89% rye, 7% corn, and 4% malted barley.
So one of the things in the that way rye presents is there is a massive difference between a 51% rye mash bill and a 95% rye mash, or even 99% rye mash bill. I mean, they're just each one is a totally different product.
Yeah, and if you guys have been following us for a while too, you'll notice that there's been a little bit of time between our rye batch 3 and rye batch 4. And that's because we are constantly looking for something that is worthy to go into that package. And rye, we like to blend something that is a little more than just, you know, your typical spice bomb, and then it sort of just trails off into nothingness. We like to have a well-rounded product, just like with our bourbons, where you do get that traditional spicy rye grain, but you're also going to get some fruit notes. You're going to get, there's some herbal dryness in there. So you're touching all parts of your palate. You're getting a good bit on the front of the palate with a nice finish. You get good mouthfeel coverage over your tongue. I mean, it's just an all-around great product.
So this one's about a little couple ticks less than the first one's, about 57-58%. This one touches hotter to me.
Yeah, I agree.
This maybe it's the rye.
Yeah, the sharpness.
Spices.
Yeah.
Sharpness, right?
Now, do you source from the different states, the different locations, and the age bits to fill, like you said, to fill out those pieces? Like you're tasting something and you're like, you know, we need to find something that maybe is a little bit older or a little more fruity or a little more whatever as you're going through. You know, like you're just slotting in the pieces to say, this is what's missing right now. I bet if we had something that was 14 years and Canadian, it would be great.
Yeah, it's a great question, Mike, and you're really spot on with that, because in these different distilleries using different yeast strains and different grain bills, we're going to generate different flavor profiles. Yeah. So what we've done over the years is familiarize ourselves with what these flavor profiles are, and so we can target them at different years, because we have a pretty good idea of what we're going to get from these larger distilleries, because they're very consistent with what they produce.
That's really nice. I like it too.
It is. I like the spice.
I'm not a big fan of rye because I find them to be spice bombs. You've really hit it here. It's what really well rounded, and it's a really nice finish.
And again, with this one, I'm not getting like, it's not heavily oaked. You know, it's not like overly dry. It's
right.
You get more of a little more nuance, a little more of the flavors. You know, some herbal notes, some fruit.
Somebody once referred to bourbon as a symphony and rye as a one instrument. And rye can be one-dimensional. And so we're very conscious of not producing something like that, of focusing on creating something that has a lot of different characteristics.
Trip, I'm going to put you on the spot. Give me your favorite line from the movie.
I think the funniest one is when Clark walks out of the garage and he has the Jason mask on and he's trying to get the chainsaw fired up, and he finally gets the chainsaw to run. He walks out and it's the neighbors, Margot and I forget the other guy's name. And he looks over at him, fires at the chainsaw, and they look at him and say, "Hey, Griswold, where are you going to put a tree that size?"
Yeah, but wait, it's the comeback, right? Because he's like, bend over and I'll show you.
Bend over and I'll like, show you.
How that's dare you right. talk to me? I wasn't talking
I wasn't
to you.
Talking to you. I wasn't talking to you. That's right.
That's the part. That's the
right. Yeah.
How about you, Joe? What's your go-to line?
It is hands down, it's such an easy one. It's when falls on the gutter and that giant icicle goes right through the neighbor's picture window, melts, it hits their what's
the stereo system, right?
Yeah,
it's like stereo system. Stereo system.
It was
Bang & Olufsen, I think.
Bang & Olufsen.
Yeah.
And then when they go there's a puddle in Detroit, and she's like, "What happened?" And he says, "I don't know, Margot." Yeah. That's the memory of that line. We actually use that in our family all the time. Like when our kids are over, we're having dinner. It's like, "I don't know, Margot." The way he delivers that line is just so good. That's my favorite.
And Mike, you got a favorite line?
I always like the worse how could things get any worse? Take a look around you. We're at the threshold of hell. Just that's any family function with my family. I'm one of seven, and if the five of us, if the tipping point is five, if five of us get together, usually something is off the rails, and it is the threshold of hell. It just is.
Welcome to Christmas. Welcome to family gatherings, right? And you got a
favorite? I like when they're going to get the tree, and it's because I've already put on the little fact sheet. You know, Ellen Clark, Audrey's frozen from the waist down. Clark, that's all part of the experience, honey. Thanks a lot, Dad.
What's funny in the original story is they don't go to a they don't go out to a field to find a tree. They actually go to a Christmas lot, and Clark is too cheap to buy like one of the last trees there. And when they look around some more for a cheaper tree, there's nothing left. They go back to the original tree, which isn't there, and now whatever raggedy tree's left has doubled in price in a half hour. And so they get home, and they have no tree, and the kids are all upset, and his wife is all upset. We don't have a tree. So he takes out a chainsaw, and he cuts down one of the pine trees in the front yard, and he brings it in the house. So a little different than the movie, but still crazy. We have one last whiskey, you guys, some long. Cask Finish Series. I'll let you guys. Amburana?
Yeah. Cask Finish. Amburana.
Ooh, Amburana. Is that the type of wood or?
Yeah. So this is, it's a Brazilian wood that is in, it's been used in the beer industry and in aging cassava for a long time. It's also used in like furniture, high-end furniture and some other things too. But what's really fascinating about this is the amount of flavor contribution that this wood imparts on whiskey. It's absolutely incredible. And it can be so powerful up front with the baking spices and the clove and the cinnamon.
Yeah, I was gonna say, is that what I'm smelling? Is that the wood?
Yeah.
That's like, wow.
So this is one of the more concentrated barrel finishes that we've ever played with. And it took us a long time to get to a point where we were actually ready to put this in a bottle because it can be so overwhelming. So we actually spent a lot of time.
Somebody's mic's acting up.
Yeah, somebody's.
Yeah, mic.
It's always Aaron. Aaron's always acting up.
It's always me. It's always me.
Look at that. Aaron leaves and now there's no more problems.
All better.
His family says the same thing.
I know.
As usual.
So with Amburana, we actually spent a lot of time seeing how the different whiskeys, mash bills, ages from the different distilleries that we like to use, how those whiskeys would interact with this wood over time. And start putting smaller blends together because this thing is so powerful.
Is it a barrel that was already pre-made that had something else in it, or you had the barrel made?
We have sustainably harvested wood that we sourced through a European cooperage that actually made the staves and raised the barrels for us so that we could have it, so that we could trace it back to make sure that things were done properly.
So it was virgin.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Got nothing was in there before. Okay. Got it.
We actually have a map of the plot where this was harvested and the whole process and method that was used. This is really a lot like the Portlandia organic chicken thing. the detail we have on these barrels.
Oh, that's and
so,
great.
And so, I mean, to Tripp's point, this is a barrel that we had made. And, you know, so Amburana is a tricky thing to work with. And so it can be, people can use staves, they can use chips, they can use dust. I mean, there's all kinds of different wood products that can go into, you know, flavoring a whiskey, but that's not what we do. I mean, this is pure cask finished. And so this product, the cask, this is the first release in our cask finish series. So we've done whiskey finishes and rum finishes and rye finishes. And we haven't done any bourbon finishes other than we've done we've used bourbon as a component, but this is the first one that is focused on bourbon with a finish. And so it's the Amarana cask. And this is actually just in the market right now. It's a very limited release. We're doing small releases of each of these. And so this is number one. The next one's the Tale of Two Islands release.
So this is 5 years total and 1 year in Amarana?
So this is, we have to put five on the label.
It's
five, six, seven, and 10.
I gotcha. It's the minimum is five. Okay.
Correct.
So what's different is, this is in the same way we did our Vantage, which is a toasted barrel product, in that there are toasted barrels that the bourbon was matured in, but there's also non-toasted barrels that is in the blend. The same is true here because the Amarana is, it's so overpowering that it is just, it's too much. I mean, it's amazing how concentrated the flavor is. I mean, this stuff always amazes me in terms of, you know, sometimes we have an ingredient that's just the most fractional amount will impact a blend.
Yeah, the one barrel or multi barrels, multiple of these kinds of wood, are you going to reuse them again and see what happens?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Once we dump it, we'll fill it with something and then we'll figure out what we do with that later.
Is Amarana one of those woods where it's kind of a hide and seek or seek and find kind of thing where you put it out like 3 months, not enough, 4 months, not enough, 5 months, too much, you know, 4 months in a week, you know, that kind of thing where you're, you know, you think you got it like any other barreling, you put it in for 6 months or 8 months or a year, but you do that with Amarana and you ruin it because it's just too much. Is that type of thing with this wood?
Different movie, yeah. Mike. Different movie.
You will.
Too much, darling, too much.
Yeah, Amarana starts to impart character on whiskey very quickly, and you'll have character in a matter of days. In some cases, you could probably use the whiskey in a week to 2 weeks, maybe a month, but it's not something that you want to let sit too long.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, there's ways to deal with that, but it's definitely a process.
We taste everything that we're finishing ongoing. All the time. That's why we have thousands of samples we tasted this. I specifically remember after a week, and it was like, yeah. Whoa. Well, so we really have to watch that one.
Right.
And so we were constantly experimenting with those things all the time. But you know, sometimes we finish things far less than months. It doesn't need to be.
Right. It's ready when it's ready.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, we'll sell no whiskey before it's time.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you went too long, I mean, you could just basically say, oh, you could just, you know, leave the bottle out open. It'll be like potpourri for the house if you go too far. Because it's intense. I mean, it really is intense.
It'd be fine for the Griswolds bathroom.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll tell you, this whiskey that is right from the barrel is magical. But there was no way we were going to put it in a bottle because it would be so polarizing.
I could see that because the flavors are, you know, it says bourbon, but then you get to it and it's like, well, is it really bourbon?
Well,
you've changed it just enough that like a hardcore bourbon dripper might get put off by it.
When we tasted this before we started blending it, I was immediately transported to the when you walk in the mall and there's a Cinnabon right inside there, and you go through the atrium and it's right there. And it's like your mouth starts watering the second you walk in. Yep. That's what that first taste was like.
I'm getting the dessert whiskey right with this. This
yeah,
give me a nice panna cotta or a cheesecake and
you and your panna cotta
or cheese. I mean,
right, there are a cheese afterward. Oh yeah,
I would drink it to a liqueur or something like.
Yeah. Hey, Aaron.
Yes.
This is what kind of wood is this again? You said Amarana, right?
Amarana.
So we got Cinnabon. Yes. And from there, my head leaped to Cocobolo, going back to like Better Call Saul with the wild woods.
Right.
I was like, okay, I'm all over the place. Bouncing all over the place.
We have a question from Sean who had put this
Sean
in the chat a little earlier. I'm not as versed in rye varieties as opposed to barley, Triumph, Optic, Chariot, etc. Are distillers choosing grains based on yield, or are they seeing them give more attention to flavor profile?
I think both are true. I think there's also a business decision in there. I think people would love to spend as much time as they can experimenting with different types of grains and whether they're growing or sourcing those grains. But also the, as you sort of deviate from the typical stuff that's used, those grains are going to get more and more expensive. And then depending on where you get those grains, and if we're specifically speaking about rye, you know, you're going to have to find a colder climate because the yields in the warmer climates are not going to be near as good as the yields in the cooler climates. And then your varietals within that are going to be, they're going to vary as well. So you've got this dream of being able to play with the infinite flavor profiles, sort of combating with the business decision of how much can I afford to go down that path.
I think that's probably true of wood too. I'm sure this barrel of Amburana was not cheap.
We pay far more for our Mizanara barrels than the full barrel of Kentucky bourbon is cost.
Back to the movie. Any other thoughts on it? My favorite of them all is the first one. It's like the one that sucked me in. And it's the one that's never on TV, weirdly enough. You never see it. It hardly ever shows up.
It's on HBO Max now. Or Max, whatever it's called.
Is it really?
Well, wait. You know the other great line is Rusty still in the Navy? That has got to be one of the... That's another one. Is Rusty still in the Navy?
Well, you know, Chevy is so Chevy in all of his movies. He's got that sardonic wit, and he's just a buffoon, and he talks over himself, and he gets himself, he flubs into he's a physical comedian, of course. He's like that in every movie. He's the same guy, pretty much.
Fletch.
Oh, yeah, Fletch, yeah.
Fletch, yeah. So before this movie.
Funny Farm was another one. I don't know if you guys like that one.
Yeah. Which one?
That was another Funny Farm. That was another great one.
Funny Farm.
I still think my favorite scene in this whole movie is when he gets locked in the attic.
Yeah.
And he's freezing, so he's wearing like his mother's fur coat and some kind of turban, and he's watching the old family movies. And you're just like, he finally is figuring out like that's what Christmas is about. It's a disaster. Yeah. You just watch the movies, and you know this is the whole thing.
And then the door opens.
And then he falls.
We didn't talk about Chevy much. You know, he's at Saturday Night Live right in the 70s, and he leaves because he wants to be a star, wants to be a movie star, right? And he goes off and does a series of movies that are pretty big hits. Foul Play, Caddyshack, Seems Like Old Times, Vacation, Fletch, European Vacation, Spies Like Us, Three Amigos, Funny Farm, and then a couple of bad ones in there. And then he goes to this movie. So he kind of did what he wanted to do. He actually had a string of pretty good numbers there. He became a fixture in American comedy on screen.
Don't you think his signature line in Saturday Night Live, which, you know, I am sure that 90% of the people listening to this have no idea what I'm talking about.
I'm Chevy Chase, and you're not.
And you're not. That's what says it all.
He made the Weekend Update
a
thing. I'm not sure they ever thought that was going to be an ongoing thing, but today it's still
And they said to Bill Murray, they said, what's with Chevy Chase? And they said, you know, when you get this sudden rush of fame, you're like an ass for like 3 years. Your family or your friends, they kind of smack it out of you and you figure out like how to be a person. And he said, and nobody ever did that to Chevy. And he's been like every show he's ever on, people are like, it's great working with him, but we don't miss him. You know, we're glad he's gone. He was on late in life. He gets on Community, and the cast of Community was like, you sit back and you're like, oh my God, I finally made it. I'm going to work with Chevy Chase. And then you realize, wow, this guy, I don't want to go to work today. He's the worst.
Yeah. And I think Chevy's kind of come to grips with it. The fact that he's like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. He knew he was kind of he came to a late in life realization. I was a jerk for a long time. And It's still with me. It's not going away.
I think
away.
He just looks at it. That's part of his charm.
He just owns it.
I'm Chevy Chase and you're not. You know, that's nothing like, you know what you're getting.
Yeah.
You know?
That's true. American icon in comedy, yet polarizing in a lot of ways. He never had Bill Murray's career, right? There was always that tug between the two of them. And they battle it out in Caddyshack. And then who has the bigger movie career? obviously, I think Bill Murray.
Well, he's
right?
also kind of a crazy individual too. So too many people are looking to work with him yes. either.
Maybe, but maybe better movie but choices. Yeah,
you know, the thing that surprised me the most with all of these movies is that I would have thought they were these monstrous box office hits, and they made like $50, $60 million, which covered the cost two times whatever it cost to make the movie. So they're technically a hit. The amount of time you see them on television and everything else, you're like, boy, these must have been huge, huge box office numbers. And like, you probably made more money selling it to TV than you did in the movie theaters.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's still part of it, right? That's part of the business.
Yeah, but it just amazes me. Yeah. I would have thought these movies made a fortune.
Did you see the Barbie cross the $1 billion?
$1 billion
in 3 weeks. Really? In 3 weeks.
$1 billion. I went to went to the movies with my son, and in the
you saw Barbie.
I did not go to see Barbie.
I can't wait to see it.
And there were a ton of people in the theater getting their concessions. They were all dressed in pink because that's apparently a thing you do. And they were running a dual ticket of Barbie and Oppenheimer.
Yeah, Barbenheimer.
I don't understand how that goes together at all.
Sure.
Barbenheimer.
Five and a half hours of movie. Yeah. That's a
but
lot.
Yeah, it's crazy. Wow. Like that's the kind of thing. Like if Barbie makes $1 billion, I would have thought these movies would have been like Caddyshack, making $100 million, $150 million, something like that. And instead they did $60-70 million tops.
So gents, what's coming up? What's new with Barrel? What's coming up?
In the fall, we're going to go out in a few markets with our first non-cask strength bourbon, the 100 proof, and it's going to be price point in the mid-50s, and it's called Barrel Foundation. We've finished blending it, and it is, well, I'm not allowed to talk about our products like that, but it's good.
Is that going to be something you're going to do? Like it's going to be ongoing.
It's going to be an evergreen product that, it depends. It depends on
the sales.
Assumption there is that everybody likes it and buys it.
Right.
We decided to do that as a way also to bring the barrel experience to other people. I mean, we're consumers too. I mean, $80 for a bottle of whiskey is a lot of money. We take that seriously. I mean, we're really careful about, nothing gets in the bottle that we don't think is exceptional. And, you may like one more than another, but that's part of our promise to the people. And so, because you've all had that experience. I mean, I'm a consumer. If I pay whatever the amount is for a bottle and it's terrible, I'm never going back. And that's just a consumer behavior dynamic. And, I think that it's easy to lose sight of that, but we haven't. And so our focus is that our thinking is it'll allow more people to come in and see what we do. And I mean, look, even at mid 50s, you guys all remember bourbon was $10 if you're growing up. Yeah. And that was for a premium bottle.
Bourbon is still a great value compared to scotch. Bourbon is a great value still in this country. And there is, as you had said, there is a lot of bourbon in a lot of warehouses. And I think we may see prices come down over the next few years because there is so much of it. But it's still a great value. So and if you can bring someone into the tent at a lower price point so that they get interested in the Barrel brand and then, look at all these other cool things you guys do. You bring them in.
Yeah, we're excited about them.
And I think to a certain extent, the science has finally caught up with the bourbon. That you're not just going out there and trying to make the same thing for everybody for over and over. And it's, let's look at different blending. Let's look at different aging. Let's look at different climates. Let's look at different barrels. Let's do different things like they've done in Scotland for years and other places just to come up with, we're not going to make the same thing over and over and over again. And I think to us, and you guys certainly hit a sweet spot there with the Aberana. That was really good.
Thank you. Yeah.
And for me, the rye, I'm not a big rye fan. The rye you made, I would drink that every day. That's a really good rye.
Do the highball, Mike. I'm telling you, you'll love it.
So you're assuming I can make a cocktail. Is that what you're saying?
It's mixing two things with ice.
It's whiskey water.
Two things at the same time?
Oh my God. You know, I'm going to walk over to your house and slap you right now.
I told you, if I have to put an ice cube in the glass, I usually drop the ice cube, so I have problems.
And you guys do a really big single barrel program, right? You guys do, because I know I've seen at High Times in California here, they have a really great display of your product. They have their own barrel picks, I believe. I think K&L might as well. So you guys do a pretty big private labeling, private barreling program, right?
We consider the single barrel program to include our private releases. And so one of the things that we really like about a private release is over a single barrel is there's a big demand for single barrels. And, you know, we actually select the single barrels. And, you know, when we're tasting through barrels, what makes it in the single barrel group is that there's something different about it. Big nose, no nose, long finish, no finish. I mean, we try to mix it up and give people different things to pick from. At the same time, we don't want to, we're not going to cherry pick all the honey barrels out of that and then leave the batches, shortchange our blended products. And so one of the things we found is that we, by doing things like private releases, and our private release bourbon series was based on different percentages of ages, that we're able to do these hundreds of micro blends and give people even more variety than just saying, I mean, at this point in time, pretty much anybody who drinks whiskey knows what a 7-year-old MGP 21% bourbon rye barrel should taste like. There's no real mystery there.
We've had a lot of those.
Yeah, right. I mean, and it is one of the greatest bourbons produced. I mean, you know, we use a lot of it. But there's, and you know, their production methodology, and this is really Tripp's thing, is their production methodology is so good that they really have consistency. Now, yeah, we do find variations. I mean, remember the gray barrels we got from MGP? It was like there was a mudslide in their brick house. I don't know what it was, but they were like gray slop, and it was. But the whiskey inside was spectacular.
Yeah. But they rolled them across the yard to put them in the truck or something.
Yeah. That was probably what it was.
In mud.
That sealed the staves better. So, you know, the flavor was different.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
right.
The flavor's different.
Yeah. Yeah, that helps too because, you know, you do get empty barrels. It does happen.
Gentlemen, this has been a wonderful evening. I know you guys, it's after 10 o'clock back east, and I don't want to keep you guys too late. Great movie to choose from. Really funny. National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. And we can't thank you enough for these wonderful samples. These whiskeys are just delicious. And it's great to meet up with you again, Joe, not in a little tiny, you know, place. Now we're on little tiny squares. And Tripp, it was great meeting you a few months ago in New York City.
Thank you
for coming on.
Thanks for having us. Yeah, this has been great.
All right, guys. Hang tight. We're going to roll the credits. Thanks again. What We Watch, when we Drink with the guys from Barrel Craft Spirits. Gentlemen, thank you again.
Okay, so hang on, folks. I'm going to roll the end credits.
Yep.
Cheers, lads.
Cheers.
If you enjoy this show, please subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, Google, Audible, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. You can also find us on boozedancing.com. And if you have any questions, comments, show, or drink suggestions, email us at boozedancing@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.